innovative energy today or our energy future. So thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, welcome. Thank you for coming and coming in from the beautiful sunshine to sit in a dark room and listen about physics. I really appreciate that. So today I get to, it's going to be a little bit more creative than the, I hope the right standing projector, than my presentation yesterday. You didn't have to be at yesterday's to come to today, but I see some overlap anyway. I'm going to talk to you about some things that are coming up, some things that might be starting, some things that haven't started yet, and some total science fiction energy sources. But first I want to know, what is it about energy that interests all of you? And you don't have to speak up, and you don't even have to participate today, but I'll invite you to be part of the discussion in whatever manner makes you comfortable. So does anyone have any particular interest in energy? Why did you come today?
Because we always use energy for whatever purposes, whether it's for food, for going someplace, whether it's personal, our own body energy or energy we get from someplace else.
That's right. So energy is fuel for our transportation, but fuel for ourselves also. Yeah, body. Energy. What else interests you about?
Because of that, we're making ethical and political decisions.
Yeah, you have to make really important choices.
So hopefully we know something about it.
Informed choices. Oops, sorry about that.
Or if we don't know anything, we'll get lucky and make the right choice.
We're driven by cost and things like that. Sometimes we need to be more on top of it than that. Yeah, what else interests you?
Clean, CO2 neutral.
Yeah, we want something that doesn't, that's good, CO2 neutral, stuff that doesn't put a lot of emissions into the air and keep heating our globe in a disruptive manner. Anything else?
The environmental leftovers.
The externalities.
Yeah. About externalities?
Unwanted, unknown burdens that
deal with. Okay, yeah, the byproducts, the leftovers. Okay, good. Excellent. What else interests you about energy?
Energy that's easy to get.
Oh.
Like hydropower in our valley.
Yes.
There's a lot of very efficient ways of getting energy, other not efficient ways.
Efficiency, location. It all depends on location, doesn't it? Anything else?
Conservation of energy. How do you...
Yeah, so it's kind of two parts to it, huh, John? Of minimizing, it's like energy efficiency and conservation. Those have to go hand in hand to really get it down. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Were you going to say something else? Okay. Anything else?
Availability, or you could say political impacts. We don't have to invade countries to...
Yes.
Give us our energy.
What's first. Best for us and our location and, political impacts. And geopolitical, I think, is what you mean, Certainly, we know that does affect our relationships with other countries and our non-relationship with other countries. Okay, great. Thank you for sharing something about your interests with me. My PowerPoint is acting up right now. There's supposed to be more pictures here. Let me see if I can get that to work for you. I just want to introduce you to myself. There it is. I grew up in national parks. My father was a national park ranger. Let's see if I can save that and get it to show up again. Nope, it's acting weird. Okay. That is so strange. Why is it doing that? Okay. For now, just while I've got a bunch of pictures up there. My father was a national park ranger, so I grew up in the wilderness and appreciating the wilderness. Or as a child, you don't necessarily appreciate what your parents do, but now I have a good appreciation of where I grew up. Crater Lake, Death Valley, Yellowstone. And I went to college in Linfield and McMinnville, and I then went to graduate school at Oregon State University. That's the MU there. Oh. Now it's
there
funny.
It is.
Oh!
Look at that!
Huh. Here we go. Okay. Okay, so I really like the outdoors, and I didn't realize how lucky I was. I really got to see a dark night sky the way that you get to see here. It's really beautiful. In a small farming town in Northern California, while my father was working at the Lava Beds National Monument. Cool place to cave. So I got to see stars, and I really started asking questions about what's up there, and that got me interested into physics and astronomy. And so as part of my research in graduate school, actually beyond graduate school, is astronomy. But in graduate school, I studied like fluid physics, which has applications to like nuclear contaminant flow from like Hanford to groundwater. And for a little stint in graduate school, I got to work on for the NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which was a real dream come true working there, except that you could not see the stars at night. And the fog, as they called it, was brown. And they would say, the fog was heavy this morning. And I'm like, guys, that is not fog. Fog is not brown, you guys. They had themselves all... And these were people with PhDs working at JPL. And I'm like, that is not fog, you guys. You can't see the stars. I got to teach an energy course at PLU. My department's very generous with their staffing and the way that we are creative and innovative with our technologies. I'm sorry for those of you yesterday. There's a few repeated slides, but I want to get everybody kind of on board with the things that I have experience with. So we started we traveled by train, the Amtrak Coast Starlight, beautiful if you've never done it before. Down the Pacific coast, looking at various energy sources, some of them innovative, some of them typical. We studied hydroelectric, nuclear, ocean wave, geothermal, solar, and talked about a few other things like wind and, of course, fossil fuels on our way, on our travels. All right, these are the things I'm going to tell you about today. A little bit, just big picture, world energy consumption. And then we're going to classify some renewable energy sources, innovations in energy production, maybe future ideas, and I'm going to have us kind of talk about that and discussion of pros and cons of these methods. And feel free, please do interrupt me at any point during the presentation. That's just a nice way to work. If you have a question, go ahead and ask it right now. So, what is physics? What do physicists do? It's hard to say because not many of my students go off and become physicists. They often use their skills in some other field, maybe even finance or some other kind of interdisciplinary science. Because physicists are pretty good at problem solving. We use laws of nature and experimental results to model physical systems and solve problems. We also embrace uncertainty. The real-world applications can be very complex, and they're influenced by many factors. Finding fundamental underlying concepts is not always straightforward. So even in physics, things are not always black and white because the applications are so complex with so many factors. Sometimes you can come up with a good approximation, but there's probably a lot more to it than a story problem that you would find in a textbook. So let's all keep that in mind as we go through with these applications. All right, so I will ask you to participate in today's session, and for you that could mean just listening and deeply internalizing it, or it could mean answering some of my questions with these multiple choice cards that you'll be folding into various things. And you can do that or you don't have to if you feel uncomfortable with that. It doesn't matter to me. It's just for some feedback. and also discussions. So education research shows that learners who participate or commit to guessing an answer, then confront the real answer, learn with deeper understanding and higher retention. How about that? Yeah, so that's how I keep my students awake and give them research-based information that keeps them awake. All right, for our first trivia, can you guess which one of these energy consumption fuels do you think the world uses most? And I'll say that it's pretty close. It's pretty close. Take a guess, and in about 30 seconds or so, hold up your card. And it's okay if you're not quite sure of the difference between some of those. I confess I did not always know that. I had to learn some of it very recently.
Everybody has a different answer.
It's true, I see a scattering of answers, which is totally fine. Like I said, it's actually pretty close. All right, I see probably mostly A's, some B's, and some C and D. So let's check it out. So it turns out that the real answer is petroleum. That's because of travel, I think. So we've got, or perhaps plastic. Plastic, yeah. So we've got 30%, and this was 2015. So all three of these categories right here are fossil fuels. And the rest of them, let's see, what else do we have? Actually, and nuclear is not a fossil fuel, but it's also non-renewable, which means it's not easily remade or at all. So nuclear is, let's see, that one, 7% hydroelectric, which is a renewable energy source, and other renewables, all of them, solar, wind, geothermal, they all fit in that really tiny little slice. This was from 2015. So yeah, that's a lot of fossil fuels that we're using, huh? And this is just another way to present that, but a historical view, so this is from 1966 to 2011. If you were in my class yesterday, you saw this one. And I want to point out here one thing. So obviously, we use a lot of oil, coal. This is from a slightly different source, so they're maybe getting really close here. And then gas rising. Interesting, hydroelectric since 1966 is staying pretty, it's pretty stationary, pretty stagnant. And then nuclear really inclines around 1980s. And then look how the renewable energies are nothing, and they're really starting, they're dramatically starting to come up here in the early 2000s. So fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal have been our primary source. Hydro and nuclear power are right behind them. Renewables making up only a tiny portion. Here's by region, Asia. So you can see the different regions over here and their kinds of energy consumption. So this is just all the energies that we use. So you can see North America is pretty high up there. I think Asia and Oceania are really growing fast. So you can see their production or their consumption by year down here. Lots of graphs. This is the last graph for now. Other renewable consumptions by region. You can see that there's really been a boom. This is year, so 1991, and this is 2011. So the renewables are really trying to go up. Really starting to go up here.
Katie?
Yeah.
In the last slide, can you say who country-wise in Asia and Oceania is really driving that?
I can't say for sure, but I think it's probably China. Does anybody know the real answer to that?
Both China and India have been expanding their energy.
Okay, yeah. Basically, increasing their quality of life also means increasing their energy consumption. Yes, I guess China, you're right, probably India too.
And population also, China and India.
Yeah, naturally population increase would, yeah. Yeah, good question,
so,
thank you.
So why did Middle East go down?
That's interesting to me. Does anyone know the answer to that? I noticed that too. I don't actually know the answer to that. Can anyone guess why in 1992 or 93 or so, was there something?
Energy demand decreases proportional to conflict, generally. Mm. So if there's conflict and displacement in a region, oftentimes the energy consumption decreases significantly.
Okay.
So like the Syria conflict, it's like a third of, the energy demand is like a third of what it was
prior
to the conflict.
Interesting. I noticed another, that's interesting, let's see about that. I noticed another one around 2008, I think?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah, good.
Maybe.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good theory. So how is our energy consumption projected to change? It's actually kind of difficult to predict this because it does depend on many factors, but here's one, the energy information. It's Energy and Information Administration projects that energy consumption is to increase by 48% by 2040. So basically, it's going way up. All right.
So why there's been so much feedback against nuclear power, I'm really surprised to see that they projected going up. Is there even a reason for that?
I think it depends on region. There's been, I think, resistance to nuclear generally in the United States, but it's used fairly regularly in like France and and Japan. So it kind of depends where you are, what the common emotions and opinions are about nuclear power.
China's ramping up its exporting nuclear power.
Okay.
Germany phasing it out.
Are they?
Rapidly.
Interesting.
Yes. In fact, I'm not sure they have any now.
Mm. Why? Do you know why?
Yeah, they don't want the waste.
Oh, okay. The fuel rods, yes. Okay, interesting. Thank you, you guys. That's great. But then there's this other issue very recently. In Physics Today, there's an article that says, as we pass the middle of 2016, this is recent, oil prices are at a 10-year low, partly because of a new surge in production of oil and natural gas from fracking. The current fracking boom may ease the transition to a new mix of energy resources. Conversely, it may make us complacent and delay the transition, or incite popular resentment and impede the transition. So it's kind of up to us where we take that. But we know that there are negative effects to using fossil fuels. Fossil fuel consumption leads to carbon dioxide emissions, which get up into the atmosphere and create greenhouse effect, warming of the atmosphere, climate change, which has many negative effects, more than I've listed here, and some that you listed for me before. So if we wanted to sustain our way of life, and perhaps we don't need to do that, perhaps we need to change our way of life, but it requires the use of natural resources. It may be direct from the source, like wood burning, oven, or natural gas fireplace, or it may be in the form of electricity, and we'll talk more about those applications. But for the past 200 years, we have relied heavily on fossil fuels. So I believe that the bottom line is that energy has sustained us, our civilization, sorry, the energy that has sustained our civilization for centuries, fossil fuels, has been abused and may only have a few hundred years left. Whatever energy source the future holds, we must learn to conserve it and value it, as you mentioned. Okay, as we go through our talk today, I'm going to ask you to be thinking about, in what big ways must our way of life change for us to consume less energy? Because I'm going to ask you about that. We're going to discuss it at the end of today's talk. And I don't just mean the individual things. I'm talking about big, big world changes. Let's think outside the box here. Main renewable sources used now are solar, hydroelectric. Actually, hydroelectric comes before. This isn't in order of use. Solar, hydroelectric, geothermal, wind, and biomass and biofuel. I talked about a few of these yesterday, and I'm going to talk about a few more of them today. All energy sources have pros and cons, even the ones that you consider the very best. But I'm going to ask you a question here. Which of these listed renewable sources originates from light energy from the sun? What do you think? Go ahead and take a guess. I'll give you a little time to work through that.
Are you specifying light energy as opposed to heat energy?
Oh, that's a good question. I probably just should have said energy from the sun. Yeah.
All of them.
All right, if you've got an idea, go ahead and raise your cards there. Okay, for those who've chosen to guess, I see a mix between C and D, and I want to get your opinion on that. I think that the answer is C, because geothermal energy comes from heat inside the Earth from radioactive materials, already present from inside the Earth. And it comes, but you could make the argument, I think you could make this argument, because it does come from the compacting of the Earth itself that causes the heat generating from the core of the Earth. But also, you could maybe argue that that is related to the sun, because we're all in this solar system and we all originated from the same ball of gas, of cosmic dust. So, I think you could maybe make that argument, but I'm thinking directly our energy sources come from the sun, solar, hydroelectric, wind, and biofuel, but I can appreciate some ambiguity in that. Thank you for participating. So I want to tell you how we harvest energy from wind and geothermal. Yesterday I talked a little bit about how we get energy from a natural resource to our homes, like via a power plant and via magnetic induction. That looks a little bit like this, and for those who were here yesterday, you saw this. You use your natural resource somehow, usually to heat a fluid, to create steam, to turn a turbine. The turbine rotates an electric motor, and by magnetic induction, it induces a current. And that current is electricity, in other words, moving charges, and that goes through our power station to power our homes and comes out our outlets in AC current. Solar energy doesn't quite follow this, as we discussed yesterday. And there's another one that doesn't quite... Oh, wind, because it goes straight from the natural resource to turning a turbine, obviously. Okay, so let's talk about wind a little bit. Air circulates around the globe, and it's actually far more complex than this two-dimensional diagram. This is actually more like, it goes diagonal, it goes like down one way, and then when it comes up, it's a little bit different in direction. So this is just a two-dimensional idea of wind moving. And the reason is because the sun heats up the land a little bit faster. In general, this is kind of how it moves, and it moves inland. The warm air over the land rises, and the cool air moves in. So in general, that's somewhat driving our wind currents. Wind flows through wind turbines, spinning them, just like our process predicted. Turbine rotates an electric motor, and the motor generates electricity. It's mainly used to generate electricity, although water pumping windmills were once used throughout the U.S. In the last few centuries. About 90 countries generate electricity with wind energy, mostly in Europe and the United States, due to government funding. That's one thing that drives innovation. Okay, here's a map of the United States, and you can see that we've got some mountainous ranges here in Washington where we do get pretty good wind energy. The mid United States would be great places for wind energy, and they already have wind turbines set up there. So the red and purple regions have the highest wind speeds and good locations for wind energy.
So why? Why are those places windy?
Oh, good question. Does anyone know the answer to that question? Why is it that it does feel like when you're on the coast you get the wind coming in from the ocean? So why is it the middle of the United States we get the most wind? Is it
the Rockies, the Rocky Mountains?
I was gonna say the mountain ranges. Okay, maybe the presence of the mountain ranges there. Yeah, that's a good question. Or rather, west of them. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure why. Wind energy can be traced back to the sun. Can anyone explain why?
Yeah, the sun's energy hits the ocean and land masses differently, which causes the air to heat up and rise and move.
Yeah, that's basically it. So the different parts of the land heat differently and create what we call the pressure gradient or temperature gradient. And so things want to move from high to low pressure, and that's where we have the wind moving. The particles in air moving, which is the wind. So can you, I've already got a list, but I want to see if you can come up with some that I hadn't thought of. Pros and cons, let's think about what's good about wind energy.
No CO2 source is free.
Yeah, that's right. So no CO2, low emissions. Yeah.
Unpredictable and unreliable.
Okay, so the cons. It's a little bit unpredictable, yep. kind of like hydro, or possibly seasonal?
It can be an ice sword.
Oh, yeah, you've got to go there and fix the system.
Or even more so, I'm not sure people want windmills in their backyards.
Oh, yes, then out of my backyard, yes. Okay, that's...
Yeah, they can even
Yeah, totally. Okay, good, thank you. So wind energy is emissions-free. Emissions pollute the air. Reduce the amount of electricity generated from fossil fuels, always a plus. Does not require water for cooling or steam, so that it skips over that part of it. It can be generated offshore in places where people can't see them in their backyard. Ocean wind farms. The visual impact, here's the cons. Nobody wants it near them. And I've heard that people don't like the sound of the rotating blade. I have not been up close to a windmill. Does it have a sound? Does anyone know?
Yeah.
Really? It does?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It shakes the ground up.
Really? Okay, I guess I can understand why folks don't want to hear that.
You can't hear it from that far away.
Really? Okay. Because I had some students visit one and they're like, it was so quiet, we didn't even hear it. So, okay, there is a sound to it.
Well, depending on the size of
it. Yeah.
The big ones.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, thank you for telling me about that. And yes, some bird and bat deaths, reducing their populations.
Many, many thousands, millions. Mm. And also, they're working really hard to figure out how they can make them be seen. The tip end of the blade is going much faster than it seems.
Yeah.
And that's what gets them.
Yeah. Do you have a comment?
I just read a book about bird deaths, and it said, the biggest factor in bird deaths are domestic cats.
Yes, it is. They get more than windmills.
Yes.
Which is why ours are indoor cats. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, it was going to be that the cats are
more.
Mm-hmm. But you also have to consider the ratio of the current bird population to the number of deaths. And so a million really doesn't mean that much in the grand scheme.
So, I don't know the answer to this question. Why are the birds attracted to it? Is it possible they're attracted to it, or they just happen to be there?
They can't see it, and they put them right in the wind, right in the air, what do they call those things where they go back and forth?
The migration.
The migration routes. They put them right on them because that's where the wind is.
Have you heard of work where they use, what they used to do with a pop bottle or a Coke thing? You turn the 2-liter thing and it would spin around. Have you heard of people starting to do that? About 20 years ago, there was a guy on Isle Royale, the guy who does the wolf study, his son was working on that.
Oh.
And I haven't heard anything about that, because then it would be more seen, because it's more solid, and it spins this way as opposed to this way. But
so that maybe rising air.
Yeah.
Well, the Cousteau Society had ships that were just, they looked like great big columns.
Mm.
And they really take up the wind. So there's lots and lots of stuff.
But you could, make them sort of almost, if you do that design, in the shape of a fake tree.
Mm.
So it'd even be a little more aesthetic.
Mm.
And maybe, who knows, maybe some animals would use it as a tree nesting and things like that.
Maybe the birds would build it and get killed more.
Maybe not.
But if they see that, so they wouldn't go in there. But
if they think of it like a sail, the way the Cousteau Society does, then those great big circular ones, when the wind comes in and goes around, it churns the thing right there.
Hmm.
I mean, they actually sailed their ship to the bottom because it was going so fast. There's all kinds of blades, too, all kinds of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them just chop everything up, and some of them throw it out instead. I mean,
this is great. Great discussion. Thank you. Yeah, no, this is great. I was hoping we'd get some comments.
Many birds migrate at night, so they...
Yes, most birds migrate at night.
You can't see that.
Yep. What if there were lights on them? I wonder if that would...
That also messes up the migration. They're attracted to the light.
They'll
actually fly to
just like,
the lights.
Yeah, so if they put lights on them,
they can confuse them. I mean, it's kind of like if you're driving home and you see something that looks very different, from what you would normally see, it can be confusing.
That's true. Yeah, so you can see that even some of our best ideas have many complexities to them, many pros, many cons, and it all affects our environment. And so it comes back down to efficiency and conservation, and we've got to have some really creative minds coming up with ideas to solve these problems, because we can't just affect the ecology in all the areas. We've got to figure out how to assimilate into that area as well. And again, we use fossil fuels, creating concrete foundations. The windmill has to be made of something, which requires mining and using rare earth materials. So that's true about all energy production. We've got to get the materials somewhere. And it's in remote areas. Yeah. Okay. I'd like to tell you a little bit about geothermal energy. This is really an interesting source. Earth's interior is hot from natural radioactivity and primordial energy from accretion of the coalescing of the planets coming together and compacting via gravity force. Geothermal energy flow is flow driven by temperature gradient from the inner Earth to the surface of the Earth. Also, water drips into these deep cracks, heat vents, and then heats, and then steam rises up. So you've got this upward moving hot steam or air. I got another question for you. You can play this game if you want to. Which locations on Earth do you think would be best for geothermal energy production? It's not everywhere. Okay. I'm seeing a bit of a scattering, mostly focused on D and C. So let's see. Oh gosh, zooming up this. I'm sorry, I blew up the only image I could find of this. Actually, there's probably plenty more. But basically, there's geothermal energy where there are tectonic plate boundaries. And so in this horribly pixelated picture, you can see that it's going to be near to the Ring of Fire, around the faults between boundaries between tectonic plates. Mm-hmm. So in North America, our only chance is up and down this coast, but we'll see a little bit more detail in that in a moment. Interestingly, there's different qualities of geothermal energy. So high-grade energy from geothermal use would be if you've got something above 150. I'm sorry about that little line. That's supposed to be a degree sign. I'm not sure why that's happening. 150 degrees Celsius is high quality. This is Celsius, not Fahrenheit. and you can use that to generate electricity. If it's between 90 and 150, you can use it for thermal energy or heating. If it's 90 or below, it's really only good for direct use, like basically sitting in the hot springs. Yes. So there's three different qualifications of geothermal energy, all useful to us. All right, so we generally categorize it into two forms. You can use directly to heat and cool buildings. This is such a good idea. So you can take heat, you can pump heat from inside the ground or under the surface to heat a building, to bring heat into a building. Or if you're in a place where there's no geothermal activity, you can still kind of use geothermal energy ideas, because then you can pump cool air or basically trade it for the heat, because as scientists we know it's heat that is transferred, not cool that's transferred, right? So you can bring cool air from beneath the subsurface into basically air condition a building. Two, it's used indirectly to generate electricity. And as before, you're going to get tired of me saying this, steam rises from the vents and turns a turbine, generating electricity via induction.
Katie?
Yes.
And I actually have a geothermal heating and cooling system in my house.
Oh, cool.
Many people do, because anywhere you can find, a source of heat, you can extract it, basically. Mm-hmm. So, we've got pipes under the ground. They run down like 10 feet underneath the ground on our property. And
you use it to heat your house?
We use it to heat the house.
Great. Excellent. And so, where do you live?
Live in Ohio, but you can do it. You can do it anywhere, because underground it stays a constant temperature; it really doesn't fluctuate.
Yeah, you don't have to get too far down.
Right.
Yeah.
So what it does is it runs a refrigerant through the pipe. It picks up heat and comes back in, and then a compressor compresses it, which then causes that fluid to want to reject all that heat, the temperature goes up and you compress it. Mm-hmm. It becomes more concentrated. So that becomes a heat source. There's a exchanger in our furnace that then heats our house.
When was your house built, or did you put that in yourself?
It was 17 years ago, and we put it in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
How come more people don't do
that? And then you can reverse the process to send heat underground.
To cool the house.
To cool
the
house, yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, back there.
I don't know if they're probably still doing a lot of that, but now they have what they call air source heat exchange systems.
Yes.
Mini splits, and they're putting those in all of them. We just put them in our house. They're good now.
Good.
Some innovation. Down to 20 below zero, they're about 85% efficient, and then they drop
really?
Up after that.
Whoa.
So
that's so encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah. You can heat your home with them, and of course,
excellent.
In summer, you definitely can cool
it. Can cool it, yeah. Isn't that such a creative idea? It's so innovative. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. Here's a fun fact. The Philippines is the second largest geothermal energy producer after the U.S. It makes up 14% of their electricity production. Electricity, that's high-quality geothermal energy. Geothermal energy cannot be traced back to the sun. Well, not directly, so to speak. I'm going to watch the time here. And this is another blown up pixelated graph. I apologize for that. But you can see the regions. Yeah. So, Klamath Falls. This is my hometown. And we're up here. Somebody can... Does anybody know the exact location of Holden? I'll let you point to it with the... Yes. I'm not totally a Washington native. Where is Holden Village? Okay. Oh, pretty high up there. Okay, so we're still in pretty high
range. On the Olympic Peninsula,
Holden
too.
Holden Village, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Holden Village.
Holden Village,
yeah. Okay, that's where we are.
Cool, thank you, Travis.
Yeah.
Excellent. So we're up there in that, and I'm sorry, this is 200, 150, and 100 Celsius. So we're up in that region where we can possibly get some energy production in this area. This is just a broad general map. But I want to tell you something about Klamath Falls, Oregon, that I'm kind of proud of. This is my hometown, or at least in high school it was, when my father was a ranger at Crater Lake. So, in Klamath Falls, the sidewalks never have snow or ice, because they've used this creative method to put it underneath all the sidewalks there, and so nobody slips, especially in the downtown area. And we call that the Geothermal Snowmelt Project. So that's one use of geothermal energy. Another one that we might appreciate. We also make beer with geothermal energy in Klamath Falls. They've come up with lots of different ways to use geothermal energy there. It's a quite a substantial production system there. The high school, the one that I went to, is heated with geothermal energy, so you've got supply, and I can assure you that it's plenty warm in the wintertime. Wow. Yeah. Can you possibly list some pros and cons of geothermal energy? It's going to be a little bit harder to come up with these. How about what's good about geothermal?
Local.
It's local. Yeah, you can use it local. That's right. Klamath is... separated from the I-5 corridor. It's kind of an isolated town out in the middle of nowhere. Not nowhere, but... when you're a high schooler, that's what it feels like.
Continually resupplied.
Say it again.
Continually resupplied.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Low CO2.
That's right. It lowers the CO2 emissions. Classic. Okay, how about some things that might be bad about geothermal?
Sulfur.
Okay.
Sulfur.
Oops, sorry.
Plate boundaries often have a lot of tectonic activity. Putting pipes everywhere, that's a bad thing.
That's a good point, Travis. Yeah, I didn't come up with that one in my list. That's good. Yes, you've chosen a region that is active in the first place. Yeah. You may not want to put pipes underground. That's such a good comment. Anything else? This is why I asked you before I show you my list. No fuel to burn means low emissions. It reduces the amount of electricity generated from fossil fuels, which reduces total air pollution. Water sometimes needs to be injected into the surface to produce the steam. So you sometimes have to replenish the water. You've always possibly got that heat, but if the water's gone, you've got to put more into it. So you have to burn something. You have to have some kind of energy to pump it back up down in there. Many geothermal locations are protected national treasures. Think Yellowstone. How would they feel if you put a geothermal plant right there? Probably not very good about it.
They see it.
Not in our backyard, says the buffalo. All right, so here's for a little bit more fun. What might the future hold if we really put our minds to it? So here's for some science fiction for us.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know, right? Floating cities. some are reality, some are close to reality, and some are just science fiction right now. So let's think about those things. Energy of the future. But remember, energy comes from somewhere. You can't get energy without using a natural resource. Yeah. To name a few that I'm going to talk about, some of these I'm going to talk about today. Ocean wave energy, which is pretty cool. Lunar energy, it's actually tidal energy because that's what drives the tides. Nuclear fusion. I'm not sure if I'm going to talk about that one. Landfill gas collection, power satellite. Let's look at all these things. Okay, so on my trip, or at PLU, we don't call them trips, we call them courses, down to, it's a day term, you don't say, I'm going on a trip. It's not supposed to be that, it's a learning experience. So we went to Oregon State University to look at their wave lab, which is really, really a cool place. And this is actually water waves going down through there. Those are my students. And here's my students looking at a very small scale version of the ocean wave technology. So this is kind of how it works, and this is just a general sketch, a concept sketch of it. So you've got in the water, and remember yesterday, if any of you were here, we talked about magnetic induction, where if you put a magnet through a coil, you can generate electricity in that coil. That's that relationship between electricity and magnetism. So you place on the surface of the Earth a floating buoy, and then from the, the surface of the water, and then from the ground under the water, you place a stationary magnet, or you can do vice versa. And as the waves move, you move this this enclosement that's magnetic, I'm sorry, this coil that's electric, and the magnet moves through it, it goes up or down. And when it's moving, when the magnetic field is changing, then you're generating electricity in that coil. And then you take that electricity, moving charges through here, and loop it back to your city. That's ocean wave energy production.
How does it affect the fish?
Yes, so that, yeah, there's a lot of pros and cons here. As you can imagine, having a very strong magnetic field in the water affects like migration of whales and that sort of thing. Populations don't necessarily want it in their pristine wilderness area. It does affect the fish. It affects fishermen community. And was there a comment back there?
Practically speaking, how much energy can you get out of one of these things? I mean, like a generator like the hydro has a really fast-moving coil and magnet system. This is just going to be around the last 5 days. Can you really get any power out of it?
Yeah, it depends on the size. And as I recall, this is a 1/30th size of the real thing. Yeah. So obviously it uses materials that have to be mined. Yeah, so it depends on the size, and this is just still a concept. It's being tested right now off the Oregon coast near Newport, but it's not a large scale or commercially viable yet. That's a good question. Yeah.
There was another technique years ago when they were talking about doing this, where the movement actually drove a mechanical motor system.
Yeah, basically put a turbine horizontally. Yeah.
It didn't just count on the movement of the magnet with the wave, it counted on the force of moving to drive generators.
Yeah, that's good too. So there's different ways to use that, and actually that's going to lead into my next slide here. You can also get tidal energy or lunar energy because the moon is the reason for the highs and low tides. And here's how it works. You could do it two different ways, and I'll speak to that one first since you brought it up. You can, as the tide moves in and out, you can basically have the current moving a turbine, and moving the turbine can induce a current via magnetic induction. Or, and this is genius, I think this is a great idea, you can have an ocean tide coming in, it rises into the shore, and then, sorry, I should face you, it's theater, I can face your audience. The tide rises in, you trap it up there with some kind of temporary dam, and then the tide goes out, and you have a turbine right here that you can now spin as you have stored that energy for when you need it, and as it falls, it turns a turbine. That's another way to trap tidal energy. And you can store it then, at least until the tide comes back in. So this gives you a little bit of variable energy use on time-wise, temporally. Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
They're not going to grow gooey ducks there.
That's right, so you affect the ocean environment right there, and I'm sure all the coastal towns will say, oh, please put that in our backyard, we want that right there, where it will disturb everybody walking on the beach. Yep, so that's another form of collection and storage of energy based on ocean. This energy can be traced back to the orbit of the moon spinning slowly outward. Slowly, very, very slowly. Yeah. landfill energy. I'm actually going to have you tell me about that, so I'm going to skip this for now. Okay. All right. I'm going to break you into, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. That seems right. Let's do 4 groups. Okay, so if you could kind of form a group with the folks around you, and we'll try to get into about 4 groups, so make sure you've got about 4 or 5 people in your group. And I'm going to give you a collection of articles. They're all the same article for your group. And here's your instructions. And if you don't feel comfortable with this, I'll join your group and we'll try to come up with something together. I want you to tell us about the innovative idea that's being proposed in these articles. And let's see, what is the innovation and how could it work? And tell me about what you think the pros and cons might be, what your group would come up with. So I'm going to have you do this for about 10 minutes or so. Okay, so we'll do waste fossil fuels and waste. Okay, so you guys are going to love this. Okay. And then I'll have you, someone in your group who's brave, present in just 1 to 2 minutes what you discovered. Feel free to use that one.
Based solar.
Well, what happens is if you want to use solar panels, you just lay them all out in a sheet, and whatever.
larger area of light pollution,
and
it concentrates at the
concentration.
Spots.
And then
Yes.
So,
All right, I hate to interrupt these really excellent conversations. I think I need to turn on my microphone again. All right, I think I've got my microphone back on now. I hate to interrupt your conversations. I know they're getting really good now. But I wonder if there's anybody in your group who would mind sharing what that innovation is, how it would work, and then what the pros and cons that your group came up with, and then maybe the bigger group can come up with other pros and cons. Basically, let's pretend we are policymakers and some engineer is giving us an idea and we have to try and decide if it's a good idea. All right, so which group would like to go first? And if you don't want to go up, it's okay. I know, I don't like to put people on the spot. Yeah.
We just had one con. If the thing doesn't work, we've sent an awful lot of natural resources out to the boonies.
What is yours?
Oh, okay. It was trying to get solar, or trying to get energy from a solar-based, solar energy farm, and getting it to and from, and the odds of getting any energy out of it are pretty little, according, you know. But we did talk about taking all the natural resources it takes to put something up there.
Although they are doing, asteroid mining, so
yeah,
if we develop that technology,
yeah,
and build a little exo-atmospheric manufacturing platform, that would be quite doable. But yeah, you know,
yeah, let me make sure the folks in the back
rocketing everything up to orbit, nominally expensive.
So yeah, this idea is a space-based solar power farm, where I think you can get 10 times more solar energy outside the atmosphere, which is part of the reason, maybe not 10 times, I can't remember what that article says, something like that. That's the idea behind that. And I think Japan is actually doing this, right? Isn't that the, they're projected for 2040 to have a solar power thing up in space that beams energy down. There's the con for you. Who wants to be standing in that region? And what unfortunate bird might be flying through that island? So the idea, I think, they found is that they would make it an island where they are like a 2-mile radius at least, where they would beam this energy in the form of microwaves, I believe, back down to the planet that they're getting from. I mean, that's thinking out of the box, but wow. What ideas do you have about that? Any comments about the solar power in space?
Yeah, they cook you from the inside.
Although the power was relatively small, it was, I can't find it now. It was like a kilowatt per.
Yeah, I was trying to compare that to something. You could see I crossed something out.
They transferred between two Hawaiian islands, and they got like, what was it, 1/1000th of 1% on the receiving end when they had. Space Energy conducted a long-range wireless power transmission test using a microwave beam between two Hawaiian islands, a distance of 148 kilometers. The result was power yield of 1/1000th of 1% on the receiving end, raising questions over whether the technique would be employed over the much longer distance between a satellite in geosynchronous Earth orbit and a ground station.
Interesting innovation.
Wow.
But then it goes on to say most of the transmission would be in vacuum, and so there's actually a relatively small part of the atmosphere that's going through. So big wasp.
Yeah.
Thin part of the atmosphere. So.
Yeah, that's a little misleading because our atmosphere is only, it gets thinner and thinner as you go up, but for all intents and purposes, the bottom 60 miles is the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so you're really just trying to penetrate about 60 miles of air. It's not thousands of miles of air.
What if it's a turbulent atmosphere?
And that's going to scatter, isn't it? Or if clouds move over, or it's humid.
Yeah, it's all those factors. Yeah. Anyway, these are
These are those science. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Would like Earth rotation, would that be a problem too?
So that's a really good question. There's a very specific orbit height that you have to choose in order to have a geosynchronous satellite, which means something that's stationary relative to the planet's surface. So in order to stay at that orbit and basically move at the correct speed, you have to be exactly at that height. Those are where some of our satellites are located that remain geostationary over certain parts. Yeah, that's a good question. And the problem is, that's really far away to get up to that speed. Yeah. Thank you for presenting that, you guys. Thanks for having me.
How much debris is in that area? Because if something breaks, you got to get somebody up there. Or leave somebody up there for a long time.
Yeah. I've got a friend who works at JPL, who at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and his job is space junk. That is going to be a... Let me tell you, young people, that's going to be job of the future, dealing with space junk. That multiplies like crazy. Since you guys are talking, would you be willing to present what idea that one is next? Here, I'll put the picture up for you. Let's see if I can find it. There
that's we go. It. Just a quick summary. It works kind of like an eyeball or a lens or a telescope where it gathers a certain area of light that's coming in and it just focuses it on a smaller solar panel. And so you get a concentrated amount of sunlight on this little solar panel. And you can, with that, you can increase the efficiency of the solar array quite a bit. So they're advertising up to 57% efficiency, which means 57% of what is received on the solar panel gets converted into electricity. And that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Is the idea that instead of having a solar panel that takes up that entire space, that you only need one that takes up a smaller amount and use it as a lens?
Yeah, you need about 25% with the design they were looking at. You need about 25% of the solar array area that you would normally need in order to catch that same amount of area that you didn't have a vault.
That's right. So what do you think? Is this a good idea?
We saw pros.
We're investing in it.
We're going to vote yes.
We came up with some pros and cons, and I think one of the pros is that you need less solar panel, and the efficiency is higher, and solar panels are, as we talked earlier, kind of dirty to manufacture. Mm-hmm. So the ball is made out of silicon, or basically sand, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so it's glass.
So that's a little easier to manufacture than the photovoltaic.
Or it's not at least not as polluting, except that you still got to form it. So you're going to be using a lot of energy to form that glass. And that was, I think, one of the cons we came up with.
Yeah.
And then another one is, if that's outside all the time, and wind and weather and rain and acid rain, sand blowing around, particles, the surface is going to get rough.
Yeah, how good is it going to be at actually refracting the light after a while? Yeah. Very good. Thank you for presenting that, you guys. Excellent. Let's see. John, of your group in the back, would you... Anybody want to talk about that?
This was just an article about improving the size of wind turbine blades and improving their efficiency.
Okay.
This is a 2012, so the blades would, how much longer are they? They're a lot lighter, so it takes a lot less foundation and tower to support them. The blades weigh 20% less than conventionally produced blades.
What are they, fiberglass? What are they?
Fiberglass with balsa wood.
Oh, and they're enormous, aren't they? Like,
yeah.
I don't have that picture on the slide, but there's like a person standing next to the very center of it, and it's just that they're dwarfed by this enormous blade.
Yeah.
And they pour it all in one thing. And then where are they thinking about putting them?
Out in the ocean.
In the ocean, okay. Putting really large blades on
this one piece. And she brought up a good point. How they transport it.
Oh my gosh.
Good point. Put it on the water. That's easy.
I guess you'd have to have a really big river way, or you'd have to make it right next to the ocean.
Well, make them in Bellingham and just send them out. Huge sound.
Jobs for the coast.
So there's also a wind farm in China.
Also doesn't grow in Puget Sound.
What's that, Zach?
There's a wind farm in China that they're ranking at the top of a mountain and they have these trucks that hold the blade at like a 70 degree angle, and so you can't go under any overpasses because it sticks like 200 feet in the air, but you see them winding up this narrow little mountain road.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Very cool. Thank you. Anything else you want to add about that? You think it's a good idea? Yes?
Yeah.
No? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. It just says here that the first wind turbines generated 30 kilowatts of energy, and they had 5 meter long rotor blades. And now the latest turbines produce 6 megawatts of power.
Mm.
So they've increased their efficiency dramatically.
Oh. Very cool.
The ends of the blades will turn about 180 miles an hour.
That's why they kill the birds.
Yeah, they're back to the birds. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh boy. All right. Thank you for presenting that. This one is fascinating. I want to hear. Oh, yeah.
I've seen fiberglass. I know it smells awful when you use it.
Say it again.
The chemicals that it takes to create fiberglass.
What does it take to make fiberglass? Perhaps I will pass that to the chemist and the engineer.
Really awful smell.
Yeah.
What's in fiberglass?
It varies depending on what it is. It's very noxious.
Oh, it is? Okay.
It's resin. You always have a resin and then some sort of structure. In this case, it's glass.
Yeah.
It's silicone.
Mm-hmm.
And resin can vary.
Thank you. That's good. All right, this one's pretty interesting. Can you guys tell us about the waste? Anybody want to?
So as we understand it, it's basically waste energy, but they're processing the waste to try to get more energy out of it than the traditional incinerator.
Yeah, so this is called landfill gas to energy production. It's actually in use. Did you know that?
Yeah.
So they're trapping gas, right? So what do you think? Is this a good idea?
Well, trapping gas is one thing from landfills. I just think implemented it almost any modern-day landfill.
Just to reduce the emissions.
Yeah, to reduce the emissions. They're no longer burning it. A lot of places are getting captured because it's just natural gas coming off of the landfill. This is arguing taking that waste and producing, like, weird burning brick walls.
Oh, that's right, the pellets.
Yeah.
Yes. So this one's not only collecting the gas waste, but also making pellets out of the waste itself.
Yeah, going a step further. That's kind of more necessary.
It's using the... You still have all kinds of
other stuff that,
stuff
you're
that goes on. You have to figure out how to sort the stuff that you need, which there's a lot of good machines out there that actually do that. But you have to figure out what you can put into the pellets, what you can't put into them. Again, you're burning, so CO2, you're going to have gases coming off, which again, you can capture some of those. But it seems like a lot of energy to use to try to make energy rather than just reducing in the first place.
Yeah, a lot of these methods involve putting something in, and it's like, is the input worth the output? Yeah, that's fascinating.
Good,
so
this isn't quite that.
I work for General Electric, and we sell turbines, just motors, right? Like jet engine type motors.
Okay.
To... sites all around the world, they put them on top of their landfills.
Okay.
And they burn the methane that comes out of the landfill.
For what purpose?
Generating electricity.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So,
we're proponents of that.
Not the pellets.
Yeah.
Okay, so we, as a policymaker, vote up for the methane and down for the pellets. Okay, great. Thank you for playing that game.
what was that structure thing? I got to know.
Oh, I just pulled that off it.
Is that houses inside of something?
So I'm trying to get you to think about the future a little bit. It's basically like vertical greenhouses. And having, like those are supposed to be biomatter in there with wind turbines through them. And I just pulled an image off of
it. That's cool.
Thank
you.
Just to try to get people to think about the next thing that I wanted to ask you about. In what big ways must we change our way of life so that we consume less energy? Maybe think about centuries in the future. And consider these things. How must cities be designed? Where will we live? What about rising sea levels? How and where and what? How most of our food will be grown? How will we define the term work? And I mean like work, like people working. Well, will everybody have to telecommute? Will not everybody work? What will daily life look like? What about transportation and travel? And I feel like we are moving towards artificial intelligence to accomplish many of the tasks that we have already, like phones and cars, library services. Think about everything that you use, like with your phone, all of those things turning into AI, a toaster, a refrigerator, and medical. How might this change our energy consumption? So if any of those things make you think of something, feel free to bring them up for the group. This is our wild idea moment.
How far out should we be thinking?
How far out? Well, it's kind of up to you. I just kind of place this as an open question. What direction do we want to start moving? And let's say like 100 or 200 years from now. Yeah. It's fascinating. I don't have any answers. I'll just say.
This is the kind of stuff that's going to actually get us somewhere. It's creating value out of different ways of operating systems. Right? Mm-hmm. You already can do it with your houses and compare to an old thermostat set on the wall versus the ones that know when you're gone, when you're coming, you know, that's the way that I think we're actually going to create value and reduce our energy.
A small scale all adds up to large scale.
It all adds up, yeah. Mm-hmm. It all adds up. And then also in manufacturing, the big industry stuff that big energy consumers, additive manufacturing, small scale manufacturing, different approaches. I think that's going to change quite a bit. And it's market will drive it because there's value creation.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's value creation, people do it, they innovate.
That's an optimistic, yeah, I love that. Yeah.
I think, I really do think we're already moving away from a point source distribution network to a distributed source network. And, you know, there's some efficiency to be gained there because the power doesn't have to go as far.
Yeah.
You're really just kind of shifting power all the time around on the network to move it from the source to the
to the need,
which may be very close by.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of putting a power station over one state and sending power to another state.
Mm-hmm.
You have the
line loss. Local is key, isn't it? Yeah. Do you think that cities will be designed with an airport in the center?
Who wants to live in it?
Like, are they going to be like metropolis?
Not the planes are like they are now, no.
But they won't be.
And is suburbia over? Like,
I don't know.
Are we done with that? I mean, think about even how like a post truck drives into cul-de-sacs. In and back out, in and back out. If that's a wasteful way to drive, right? So all of these things, I mean, I hope this maybe generates some conversation. Anybody got more comments on this?
I think Holton Village is an example because, I mean, if you had gardens here, you have pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. It'll be...
You do.
Well, I know, but I mean, to do food year-round, fish and all that kind of stuff that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether you can do that with large-scale cities and all the farmland.
Yeah.
You know, how would that impact that, and what kind of cultural change, what we eat would change, that kind of thing too. I mean, I think ideally it'd be wonderful, but is it going to be work sustainable?
There was we had a little exercise at work where we used a program online to kind of calculate our carbon footprint, and transportation for me anyway was a huge part of my footprint, and I imagine.
Yeah.
Even at Holden Village here too, it's transportation's pretty high. If you look at how much energy we took, each of us to get here,
in addition to like the clothes I'm wearing and where it was made and the dye for the clothes and the people who sewed it and how many times it was transported across the Atlantic Ocean to get to me. Yeah, those are all factors to consider.
I think the food's going to be manufactured up in space and habitats eventually.
Neat idea.
We're looking, ways in the future, but something like that, because in your sunlight, everything is all the same all the time, so you don't have variable conditions.
We just need that nanotube elevator, don't we?
That's the hard part.
Did you have a comment?
We don't talk about birth control anymore, but when we started in on this green stuff, it was way back in the 70s, we talked a lot about birth control. In fact, the Audubon Society talked about birth control. I mean, they had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get there
You can't get there from here.
Yes,
you have to have some kind of problem with controlling the birth of human beings because we're the ones doing it.
Working with one child per family.
Yeah, but that's gone.
That's recently been, yeah.
Yeah, they did it for a long time.
Well, I hope this conversation continues. To close, I've got, I want to read you something. This is a poem that I wrote. I've been working on writing children's books to try and encourage a positive message for children in science. And this is one I very recently wrote. It's still in draft form, but I'd like to share it with you. It's about energy. One little child was quiet and plain. She listened to a drip-dropping sound. Then the sky poured. She watched the rain move fallen leaves around. Then it was sunny. She felt all the heat that sunlight gave to the land. The puddles were warmer and steamed off the street. She saw this cycle firsthand. Water and sun, they seemed so grand. She wondered what nature could do. The wind could blow with a mighty force, lifting leaves right off the trees. She wondered, of course, what could be the source. A breeze could power with ease. From hotter to colder, from high than to low, the wind moves round and round. Must different parts of the earth make it flow? These questions made her science-bound. Many connections and patterns she found. She wondered, she wanted to know. She tried and learned as much as she could about nature and motion and places. She thought very hard and found what was good for leaving the smallest of traces. She found other thinkers who liked to build too, and they became her peers, succeeding and failing as scientists do. Sometimes this process takes years. Magnets and wires and building with gears. She couldn't just do this alone. As she grew up, she developed her knack, and with others she formed a dream to better the globe, a code they could crack. They began to see a theme. For every location, every place, every nation, electricity from a force. Each place could have its own power station, and each from a suitable source. Energy close to their homes, of course. Local, that was the key. See, energy takes a leader, a learner, a reader, a person who likes to observe. This one little child saw her fate as a seeder of ideas for others to curb. Where are we headed and what do you see? It only takes one spark. One person with one idea, maybe three, for many to make their mark. Science can move us forward, you see. Imagine, what else could we do? Thank you. Thank you for coming to my talk.
I do have evaluations that people could kindly fill them out.